a program devoted to the largest segment of society, to those of you who realize that the world's religious, political, economic, and military institutions are counterproductive, corrupt, rotten to the core, irresolvable. I'm Yada. Our phone number, if you'd like to join us over the next 2 hours, is 877-376-45. Scott, I heard the news that the NFL is giving up its tax-exempt status because of some uproar in Congress. And the way that it was stated, I assumed that, could it actually be that the teams were tax-exempt, that guys like Jerry Jones with the Jones Mahal down there in Texas with the Shrine to football weren't paying any taxes, even though they were making, you know, millions of dollars on their franchises and then selling these franchises for billions, that they were tax exempt? And they said, oh, come on, there is no way that they could be tax exempt. Come to find out that's not the case, is it? Oh, we had Scott in my ear. We don't have him anymore. But so, is the are NFL teams tax exempt today?
No.
Have they ever been tax exempt?
No, the NFL teams have never been tax exempt.
There's only one tiny aspect of the NFL that's tax exempt, and it's not a team, is it?
It's not a team. It's the head office. It's the
So the players aren't tax exempt. The teams are not tax exempt,
nope.
And the employees of the head office of the NFL are not tax exempt.
Nope.
The only thing that's tax exempt is that, you know, unions, for example, are usually tax exempt. So the players' union is tax exempt. Well, the if you would say the league office, which would be the owners' union,
yep.
is to be on equal footing with the players' union. They would be tax exempt. So if the league put money in its coffers for do-gooding, you know, they were going to, because they donate a lot of money. Until they donated the money, there would be no tax write-off. They would have been able to retain their whatever the teams pay them in their bank accounts without being taxed on it, which is probably not a big deal because of two things.
It's already
one is
money.
they donate most of the money that comes into the league office, and they would get they'll get you know, charity write-offs for that anyway. And number two, where does the vast preponderance, the overwhelming preponderance of the money that comes into the league office, where does it go? Roger Goodell's hip pocket. $42 million, I think.
Well,
annually.
They make way more than that, but most of it goes to the what the head office does is it's to promote the game of football.
Right.
So they like you said, they donate a ton of money to youth football.
I already set aside their charitable donations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their research into concussions, their charitable donations. If you set all that money aside, because it's going to be tax exempt anyway,
yep.
it's going to charities. So you're now just leaving the amount of money that they don't give away. Where's the preponderance of that going?
It's going to their employees, and Goodell's their highest paid employee.
$42 million a year. Does Goodell pay tax on that $42
million? Oh, yeah.
He's a resident of what state?
New York, I believe.
New York. Son of a gun. So he's paying a little over 35, maybe probably, I think with the new laws, he's probably paying 38% federal tax, plus he's paying 12-13% New York state tax.
Yeah.
So is the federal government and the state government getting about half of what he makes?
Right around that, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. So, oh my God! All we got here is symbolism, but stated in such a way that it sounds like, oh, you see, those rich guys—they don't pay any tax.
Yeah, and the problem with it is that everybody thinks that they. when they say the NFL is tax exempt, there's a large group of people out there that think that, oh, all the NFL teams are tax exempt.
Oh, that's what they said, that the NFL was tax exempt. So if you, you know, if you listen to the news, you'd say, wow, how can that possibly be? And my first reaction is, no, it can't be. And son of a gun. No, it can't be.
No, it's not. The teams are a separate entity. That's why when you sue the NFL, you're suing the head office and not, you know, you don't have to name every team in your lawsuit.
Yeah, what a ridiculous. God, what do we got against just simply telling the truth as opposed to misleading people?
Well, and they said that the only thing this is going to cost the NFL is like an extra $10 million a year, which they were probably paying more than that, trying to like explain to people that we're not, the teams aren't tax exempt, and fighting with
Congress
and stuff
like over that. The league, which is the union of the teams,
yep,
having the same status as the union of the players.
Yep.
We're not going to fight them over that, even though, that would be parity.
Well, they say that they don't know how much money they were putting into lawyers and things like that to do that, but they think the league is actually, it's only going to cost them something like $10 million more for being not tax exempt.
Of course.
But they think that that money is going to be made up because they won't have all the legal fees.
Yeah, so. Of course. Of course, because the money they pay Goodell is a deduction, is against their earnings. You know, any cost goes against profits. You get taxed on profits, so that's a deduction. All their employee costs, all of their office related costs, and all of their charity deductions.
And that's another side effect of this whole thing is that now they don't have to announce how much they pay Goodell. They don't have to say anything about how much they made or anything like that. They
Goodell has got to be the most overpaid man in the world.
I wish I had his job.
Yeah, I mean, we pay, I guess now, our president about $400,000 a year, and while that's a trifle amount to the amount that they gain through quid pro quo bribes, you know, their first speaking engagements, they get paid tens and twenties of millions of dollars based upon things they have done while they've been in office. The reality is that Obama does a worse job for the money that he gets, but in terms of a guy doing a poor job, and is, can you imagine getting paid $42 million a year?
Well, on the flip side of that, no, I can't. And
no.
And the other thing is I can't imagine what it would be like to work for a company that makes $25 billion a year.
No. The NFL only makes about $12 billion a year in gross revenues, and that's gross revenues. That's that. Half of it goes to the players, and then of the remaining half, most of that, the vast preponderance of it, goes to expenses and stadiums and all that kind of stuff. So, no, they're not making that kind of money. That's their gross revenue is, and I think their gross revenue is, I think baseball's now in the $8 or $9 billion level, and football's about 50% beyond baseball. And that would be gross revenues, not earnings.
Okay.
Yeah, a huge difference between gross revenues and in earnings. There's a lot of businesses that have gargantuan gross revenues. You know, you look at a company like ExxonMobil, you know, they would have gross revenues that would just be mind-bogglingly large. But they're only bringing EBITDA, a tiny portion of that, down to the bottom line, you know, 5%. 6% of the gross revenue that is actual profit, and then
giving
half of that up to the government.
I can't imagine working for a company that makes billions of dollars a year. So, I mean,
yeah. Well, the league actually doesn't have all the teams collectively. There may be a $1 billion spread amongst those 32 teams. I mean, there's no poverty in the
NFL. No,
there is no poverty in the NFL. There's no poverty in Major League Baseball. There's There is some poverty in basketball for teams that are held and not sold. When they're sold, there is prosperity.
Again, you shouldn't be an owner of a pro sports team and be complaining about money.
Yeah, that's true.
You are an owner of one of 32 things like this thing that you own at the most.
Right.
32 at the
yeah.
most
yeah.
Of this thing that you own. And you're telling
it's
me
one of the shortest books ever written is Poor People I Have Met Amongst Owners of Professional Sports Teams.
Did you even get a page down? I mean,
well, no, there wouldn't even be a name.
Yeah.
There are no poor.
I wrote the entire book.
It is. You know, you get to the point in life where you have so much money that you just. You not only can't spend it, there aren't enough things. You know, you can't buy a yacht big enough, an airplane fast enough, a house extravagant enough to make a dent in your money, and you get bored with even trying to give it away. I guess you can do what Steve Ballmer did. You can overpay by three times to buy a sports franchise that's about ready to be knocked out of the playoffs here in the first round.
But yeah, but even still, he's one of 30 guys that owns that. So
that's right.
Here I am, you know, and like you just said, you get to a point with money to where you can't spend it. There's no way
right.
you could spend it all.
What was Ballmer going to do with his money?
Yeah.
And he even said, okay, so I overpaid for the team. What do you care? You know, I've got billions more where that came from. What was I going to do? You know, I'm an old guy. I've got everything that I could possibly want. I was looking for something to do that would be fun. So someday make me relevant now that I'm not the CEO of Microsoft anymore.
Well, I have said that if I magically stumbled upon $40 billion or something like that, I'd buy every sports team I could in Minnesota. Just
okay.
Because that's what I would do. That's what I'd find. I find.
God, I hope that happens because I'd get good seats to games.
Anybody listening can come to the games.
Yeah, Scott, why don't you tell us that we're on a serious item in the news here. Why don't you tell us what you're going to be doing on Thursday evening during the NFL draft?
Sure, I can do that when we come back.
Okay, we'll listen to what a high roller. Mr. Scott himself will be doing where he will be during the NFL draft, not like the rest of us commoners. So, my friend, Scott, I understand that you're not going to be watching the NFL draft with your bowl of potato chips and salsa on your sofa with beer handy nearby like the rest of us, mere mortals, but that you're going to have a different environment altogether, different place that you're going to be watching the NFL draft.
Yeah, I was invited to the draft party. The owner of the team I'm a coach for got invited by somebody on the Vikings staff to come to their draft party. So I'll be there.
That'll be a different experience for you. That's the biggest draft there is in sports is the NFL draft. Big, major televised events. They do, what, rounds one and two on Thursday?
Just round one on Thursday night.
Okay, just round one.
Just round one, and then Friday is two and three, and then Saturday is 3-7, I think.
Okay. So, and where are the Vikings drafting in round one?
The 11th. 11th overall.
Do you know where my Seattle Seahawks are drafting in round one?
You're not.
That's right. They won't.
You traded for.
You see, I was invited to the Seattle Seahawks round one draft party, which doesn't exist. I'm just kidding. Uncle Pete didn't call, and Paul Allen didn't call. But they're not drafting in the first round anyway. So if you're invited to the NFL draft tomorrow night, I would assume that you'll be getting an invite, and you'll bring on your good buddy to go play Augusta maybe within a couple of weeks.
Augusta's now within our reach, right?
Okay.
I'll rub apples at this thing, and we'll we'll see where we get.
Okay. Wow. Exciting.
I still say you're the better option for Augusta, but.
I don't see anybody handing out invites. After all, they have Condoleezza Rice as a member of Augusta, and I think she is amongst the most despicable people on earth. She was part of the gang in Washington under King George II and the Emperor Palpatine of Star Wars infamy, Dick Cheney, that decided that America would emulate the Roman Catholic Church during the Inquisition and start torturing people, and that if we tortured people, we'd really earn the world's respect. And she was National Security Advisor during the time that we decided that we would secure America's security by torturing people for information. So, yes, then she is a member there, and I'm disgusted by her. Chances are, I'm not going to get an invite anytime soon.
Well, I'll see what I can do.
Yeah, and of course, Eisenhower was one of the most famed members of the club, and I think Eisenhower was a despicable president and despicable military leader. I think he his decisions were hellacious as it relates to what he did for Stalin and the USSR, what he did for Mao Zedong, and what became communist China, and his decision that he would launch an invasion into Europe from England across those heavily protected beaches that became a killing zone, rather than going up through through Greece, which would have been vastly less deadly and more effective than the English crossing. So I'm not a big fan of either. He's one of the most famous members of Augusta. The German government was told about the risk of flying over the eastern Ukraine before flight MH17 was shot down. But they didn't bother to pass that information on to the pilots. That's the news out of Germany. Diplomatic cables sent 2 days before the crash said that the situation had become very alarming, German media officials now say. Now, Scott, do you think that there's any chance in governmental complicity, or at the very least, governmental stupidity, in allowing commercial airline flights to go to fly over an area where the government of that country was not only flying bombing runs over the citizens of Luhansk and Donetsk, but to protect themselves, the citizens of Luhansk and Donetsk had begun to shoot down those airplanes that were bombing them. Now, do you think flying an airplane full of civilians over that area was wise? What's amazing about this article, which just says that the German government was warned that it was a really bad idea to fly commercial aircraft over the eastern Ukraine.
To answer the question you're going to ask me,
yeah,
I don't think there's any limit to how stupid governments can be.
That is true.
So if they were given a warning, I still think that them flying things over is completely within their realm of stupidity.
Yeah, there's not a lot of things that governments really ought to do for people, but creating safe flight corridors and separation between aircraft is one of the things that government ought to do. And in this particular case, it's actually paid for in the aviation fuel. Aviation fuel is heavily taxed. The tax for aviation fuel goes directly to the FAA, and the FAA uses that funding to provide flight services, which include separation between aircraft flying IFR, instrument flight rules. So that's one of the functions of government. Businesses, the airlines, pay for that function. The government failed the people. They're just pure and simple. I mean, even if they hadn't been sent a cable, okay, you are in the German government responsible for flight safety, and you had not received a communication that says, hey, you know, there are Ukrainian bombers and fighters that are bombarding civilian targets in Donetsk and Luhansk. And the people in Donetsk and Luhansk are shooting them down and have been successful now in shooting down four or five aircraft in the last few weeks. Probably you could deduce from that, if you were responsible for guiding aircraft safely, that we probably ought not fly a commercial airliner over that area, because it's impossible to distinguish one type of airplane from another when they're flying at 30,000 feet. I mean, you wouldn't have to be the smartest guy in the country to figure that out.
You would think. I mean, you'd think it would be just like if there's road construction on I-35. Okay, maybe I'll route around I-35 because of road construction. So.
Yeah. Except in this particular case, there was airway destruction.
Well, yeah, I mean, you would think that it would be just as simple as, oh, I don't want to sit in traffic forever.
Right.
I don't want this plane to be shot down. Let's move it away.
The Russian rebels in Luhansk and Donetsk in the east were not bombing Kiev. And so if you flew over Kiev rather than Donetsk, chances are you'd be safe.
I feel like this is a really simple thing. There's a war here. There's not one here. Where do you want to fly over?
Yeah, and if you looked at Europe at the time, how many places were aircraft being shot down because they were bombing civilian targets? So if you take the entirety of Europe, why don't you tell me how many places other than Donetsk and Luhansk civilian targets were being bombed and people were trying to protect themselves by shooting down those bombers? Where? Other than Luhansk and Donetsk.
Does nowhere work? I don't know. I mean, I don't know what we're doing in the Middle East. I'm sure that...
Well, that, but is that's not Europe.
So, yeah.
Where else in Europe?
Well, there you go.
Nowhere. I mean, it's not exactly tough to figure this stuff out. You know, even in the...
Again, the stupidity has no boundaries. There's no boundaries to stupidity.
Now, if you were to say, no, you're given a free ticket anywhere in the world, and you could go fly anywhere in the world, would you pick a destination in eastern Syria or western Iraq as your vacation spot of the day?
No.
No. No, I mean, a little common sense would go a long way. It's just too bad that none of it exists within government, or that the Germans, who want to blame the Russians, don't take responsibility. And by the way, if the Ukrainians were shooting down airplanes because those airplanes were dropping bombs on their civilian cities, whose fault is that? If you were to look at cause and effect, who caused that?
Probably the guy that scheduled the flight.
Yeah, that would be the Kiev regime. And who provided the money for the Kiev regime and the incentive for the Kiev regime and the intelligence to the Kiev regime and the military capability for the Kiev regime when the country went bankrupt?
That was us, wasn't it?
That was the United States, wasn't it? And Germany and a few others contributed. But yeah, that would be us. So who is really responsible for the downing of that aircraft? The people who are trying to protect themselves, or the people who caused the calamity in the first place and enabled it? You know, Scott, if I'm going to put it in a simpler term, if I lie to you and I say that that ugly creep over there, he raped your sister and he tortured your brother. And then I put the two of you in close proximity, and you punch him in the nose. Who's responsible? If particularly if I lied to you.
Well, it'd be you.
Yeah.
You would have to take some blame in it.
Right. Yeah. And what if I gave you the baseball bat to whack him with?
We would both have blame in it. I mean, it's not like I'm innocent in this because I'm,
you're not. You're not.
But yeah, no, I know what you're saying, and I knew it.
Yeah.
I mean.
And what if you knew that that I was a disreputable scoundrel and that I was lying, and then I was providing weapons? Would you, in good conscience, as just an innocent individual, then go to the area where I could whack you with a baseball bat if you knew, in fact, that I was providing this weapon and I was deceiving those deploying the weapon?
No, I wouldn't listen to you.
No, of course not. No, so it's, again, we just ought to think our way through things and come to understand cause and effect. Cause and effect's an important thing. Hello, Glenn. You know a thing or two about cause and effect. Yeah.
About the civilian airliner, the thing about that, though, given its altitude, that thing wasn't taken down by a machine gun fire at the ground level. It would have had to have been like a surface-to-air missile, sure, like a shoulder-mounted missile. But they found that, fuselage peppered with machine gun fire, apparently. That was my understanding originally.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of the skin of that airplane. And the pictures of the skin of the airplane, the one that was the most telling, that they showed specifically to demonstrate what caused the plane to come down, was, let's say the piece was, I'm going to approximate it here, 5 feet by 10 feet. That's a pretty good size piece. That piece was riddled with perfectly round holes, puncture wounds, and the holes were on average maybe 5 or 6 inches apart. And so there would have been maybe on this thing 100 or so of these holes in the round holes in the fuselage. Now, if you're blowing up a missile and the missile has shrapnel, the shrapnel typically is irregular in shape. Now, is it possible they have ball bearings and the ball bearings all have the same diameter and they all went into the aircraft? And I guess that's possible. But the section of the fuselage that I saw did not look like a missile strike. You know, and a missile strike, what you expect is catastrophic damage to wherever the impact of that missile was on that aircraft. You would expect catastrophic damage. You know, and a lot of missiles too are heat seeking, so they would seek the engines of the, I think it's a 757, so there's an engine on either side. They would have sought the engines of the aircraft, and so you would never have had a symmetrical pattern of holes in the fuselage. But that's what we...
Yeah, exactly. And furthermore, if it was a machine gun bullet, some of the bullets would have been lodged in the wreckage of the plane that they would have found bullets lodged in the plane. So and they could have determined the exact caliber of the bullet and so off. Anyway.
I think the high likelihood on that scenario, and it's, we don't know for certain, but I think the high likelihood is that the Kiev regime, at the insistence of America and other NATO countries, was providing the intelligence, providing the motivation, providing the money for the Kiev regime to bomb the ethnic Russians not Russian nationals, the ethnic Russians in the East that didn't want any part of their coup. And that those in Donetsk and Luhansk, we know for a fact, seized a number of Ukrainian military bases there and confiscated the military hardware, which they knew how to operate because anybody over the age of 40 had served in the Russian military because 20 years ago it was part of Russia as mandatory service. So they had served in the Russian military. They knew how to operate them. And so they got the Russian-built, actually Ukrainian-built, because the Ukrainian was the primary weapon supplier for Russia. They got the Ukrainian-built Russian equipment from those bases so that, A, they could use it in their own defense, and, B, so that it wouldn't be used against them. And one of the things that they seized, and it made the press in many places around the world, was a one of these Bach missile launchers. And so once the Kiev regime started a regular onslaught of bombings over Donetsk, they put these things in position to protect themselves, and they mistook the civilian airliner for another bomber. I think it's as simple as that. A week or so ago, CNN reported that a teenage Australian jihadist carried out a Islamic State suicide attack, and that he developed hatred for the West over the Afghanistan and Iraq wars before settling what it calls on radical Islam as a vehicle for violent global revolution, according to his blog. Scott, is there peaceful and radical Islam? Is there moderate and extremist Islam?
The answer is still no.
Yeah, the answer is no.
It's the same answer every day. I've noticed that. It's pretty much it comes back the same way every day.
Yeah, it's, you know, how many different Muhammads were there revealed the Quran and established the Sunnah or example for Muslims to follow? Were there multiple Muhammads? A peaceful Muhammad and a jihadist Muhammad?
No, just the one.
Is there a second Quran that is the radical Quran, since the other one is deemed to be moderate and peaceful by those who are wholly ignorant? What is this myth of radical Islam? You know, Lindsey Graham, the senator from I think he's South Carolina. I want to give North Carolina more academic credit than having a nincompoop of Lindsey Graham's character. He all but announced his presidential ambitions yesterday, and the plank of it was he was going to use the Reagan strategy of peace through strength to eradicate radical Islam. We were going to go to war with those radicals wherever we found them.
How well
did the Afghanistan and Iraq wars turn out for us?
Yeah, not real well. We didn't accomplish our goals. We have to keep having to go back.
In fact, we made bad situations worse in both situations, didn't we?
Well, it's, you know, when an empire would conquer a nation, it would conquer the nation, you know.
Yeah.
We've got like an empire that's ambivalent. It can't decide whether it wants to be an empire. It wants to, but it doesn't. It doesn't just take things over, you know.
Can you imagine, though, what would have happened? What the United States did is we just essentially broke Iraq because the president wanted to be a wartime president. So we went in and broke Iraq. We went in and broke Afghanistan. Who knows the reason why we went into Afghanistan? Because there were no Afghanis responsible for 9/11. And who knows why we went into Iraq, because Iraq had no affiliation with any Islamic terrorist organization. But we went in and we decided we would invade both of those two countries. Imagine what would have happened if we tried to occupy Iraq on an ongoing basis, conquer it and claim it to be U.S. East, the 51st state of the United States. We're gonna conquer them and keep them. Can you imagine trying to impose Americana on that group of Muslims?
Yeah, no, just to actually just kind of have to go further and have a real grind them down to a real oppressed state, then they'd probably accept it.
But, well, you know, you can. It is always possible within certain limits to be so draconian, to be so merciless that people finally capitulate under fear. So you could you create a culture that was free and uplifting, where there was opportunity for the people, and have them not want to kill you at every turn? No.
No. You could just make it oppressive and draconian, like they want to make things here.
Yeah,
you know, that's going to be the universal policy.
Yeah, that you could have done, and what would you have gained from doing so?
Access to their economic output.
But their economic output fell by 80% post-invasion.
Well, that's post our present invasion. If it's been like a real invasion, it took over. You know, you have the opium.
So you want them to be slave labor. We'll just use them as slave labor, and we think that with slave labor we're going to get the same economic output as we would have, and when we're going to have an invasion, we're not going to break anything. We're not going to break their electric grid.
No, not quite. You know, just a little better, but not a whole lot better. I think I have a couple of answers for you.
Yeah.
Number one, I think I have the answer about the terminology radical Islam, because your definition of what constitutes religion would be different than theirs. Yours is based on the doctrines espoused in the books.
Right.
Theirs is based on some socio-psychosocial, you know, sociological, anthropological type definition of the way the organization exists socially at the moment.
You keep saying, but
the book says, and if you look at the history, they're saying we're not looking at that.
No. So there's a Allah and Islam apart from the Quran.